You're listening to the Blue Box Podcast, and for the next 60 minutes, we're going to be talking about Doctor Who so that you don't have to. Hi, I'm JR.
Hello, I'm Lee.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight...
Get on with it.
All right, that was Despicable Lee. He usually turns up when you're not here, Lee.
Well, we can't tonight... be in the same room together, otherwise we're short out time.
So fortunate that we're doing it on Skype then, eh?
Hey.
They've got the same proportions, haven't they?
They've got the same. They've got exactly the same proportions, the same colour, and the same facial expression. Mm. And also, this particular one that I've got is clutching his belly.
Oh my God, I'm doing that.
You are now, to stop your sides from splitting. Or maybe not. Okay, tonight we are going to be talking about.
Series one.
We are. Well, obviously, we're going to split this podcast in two again because there's 10 stories to talk about. Mm. We should probably have split that season 18 podcast in two because we could have talked to Andrew about that forever.
Mm-hmm. We only just got to the subject of Burgundy, didn't we?
Yeah, and we could have had half an hour on Burgundy. As per usual, the listeners of the Blue Box podcast have voted for the stories into their order of preference. And on tonight's podcast, we'll be talking about the five least loved stories. Mm. Do you know what, though? Series one, yeah, okay, there are some that aren't as good as others, but it's pretty much of a fairly decent standard.
Agreed.
Mm. Until we get to the three stories we're going to talk about first, and then we'll say, oh, maybe not so much.
Okay.
All right, the story that came in last in 10th place. Do you want to guess what story came in last in 10th place?
Ooh. Well, I'll have a go.
Go on then.
I was thinking it might possibly be the obvious one, which is long game.
Just say it. Oh, the long game.
Yeah.
Simon, what do you think? Could it be that or might it be something else?
Would be a Slitheen story.
Which one?
Ooh.
I don't know.
Boomtown?
Boomtown would be, yeah, it's the weaker of the two, isn't it? Or am I saying too much already?
That's what you
well,
think.
Well, or else Aliens of London is the one that everybody hates.
Is it?
Is it?
Okay.
Oh, were you not aware of this?
No.
No, we live in our own little world.
We live in a bubble.
Anyway, the story that came in last doesn't have any Slitheen in it at all. And it is The Long Game.
Oh, okay.
The Long Game, then. It's not brilliant. But it's not bad by any stretch of the imagination. It's one of those stories that in many another series, when I say another series, I mean not Doctor Who, if that turned up just as a 45 minutes on telly entirely on its own, you know, you'd be pretty blown away by that, wouldn't you?
I think so. I thought it was a lot of good ideas in it. I mean, it didn't really rumble along plot-wise, there wasn't a lot going on in it necessarily. I mean, we know that it was kind of a rescue script from the 80s or something, wasn't it, that he sent in?
Well, he didn't say he sent it in. He said he'd had the idea. And
oh, he had
the
idea.
The
80s. Right.
On the point of
it feels
that
like
not much. On the point of that, not much happens in it. Yeah, that's fair enough. But I rather like that with the 45 minutes. I think if you try and squeeze too much story in, it doesn't work. Mm. But if you've got too little story for the 45 minutes, then you can expand it out with the characters. Mm. And I think the good thing he does in The Long Game is the characters.
I think, whether I'm jumping ahead in the conversation here a bit, but I personally think there may be a certain dislike of it because it refers to modern or present culture more directly than any other Doctor Who story. If you think about the Big Brother reference,
that comes afterwards.
That's afterwards, is it?
That's Bad Wolf. Yeah.
That's Bad Wolf.
Yeah, but it's set on the same station.
Oh, it is, isn't
That's
it?
Why you're getting confused.
Oh, I'm getting very confused. Yeah,
but they're very similar in tone.
2005, that was a long time ago.
My God.
You're right. Do you know what? Actually, before we carry on, I'll just say something about that. It's very interesting. 2005, my son was 5, right, when he was watching this. And he just got into it. Now he's 15. He's looking at 2005 as nostalgia. How weird is that? Because to us, it's almost like still yesterday. Mm. And we think it's New Who. But he's looking at it as nostalgia now.
Well, yeah,
seeing it before my very eyes unfurl. You know, I'm a mini me, a mini despicable me sitting there.
But what a huge difference though, because when we were 15, looking back at stories we're on when we were 5, we saw them once when we were 5. We never saw them again. Not by the time we were 15.
I know.
And here he is, something like The Long Game or any of those other episodes from that first series. How many countless times has he probably been able to watch those?
Probably 8, 9, 10 each, because he's got the box sets and he watches them over and over again even now. So, yeah, and it's not like the things about, you know, the way you watch stuff nowadays. You can't just watch one episode, say like we'd buy Revenge of the Cybermen video in 1986 or whatever. He watches a whole season in one go because he gets the feeling for it. He gets the mood. It's got a complete tone to it. So he'll sit and go, oh, I want to watch the Eccleston era. He knows how it feels when he watches it. It's all one lovely kind of tone to the whole series, actually.
Mm. I very rarely watch just one story from any of those series, actually. Mm. If I'm watching Doctor Who, you know, new Doctor Who, I'm the same. I'll watch series 2 or series 1 or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm.
But the way they've been re-repeated on BBC Three and what have you, it's very, very easy to just keep watching them in series, isn't it?
Easily.
Show these little batches of episodes.
Yeah. Even like you say, The Long Game, which would be considered, well, is considered the weakest of the bunch. You know, the fact that they had the Jaguar Fest of the Holy Hadrojassic Max and Rodenfoe up on the ceiling there, that was like a little bit disappointing. You kind of think, oh yeah, we want a proper monster. But actually, I really liked the fact that it was up there looking down like this big globulous thing that couldn't speak.
And it was an interesting idea.
It was. I don't know whether... Was it trying to say something about the BBC? Because it was a station of news and you know, eventually it becomes Bad Wolf, which is, you know, the entertainment channel. Was it kind of like the big overseeing, omnipresent BBC god that everybody refers to that doesn't exist?
I don't think it was BBC so much as just television in general. Yeah.
Stranger than is how you just... pronounce BBC. You went BBC.
BBC.
Listen to this podcast back.
BBC.
Make an effort. Listen to one of our
that's
podcasts. BBC, you said.
BBC.
You said
all right,
BBC.
But as we bring up points, let's address the points as they come up.
I'm sorry,
than going
yes.
Straight past them.
Okay.
This alien in the ceiling, right? It's okay, is it BBC or is it television in general? It's more about the culture of having millions of satellite channels that only a dozen people are watching, really, isn't it? It's more about this culture of being able to press channel select on your Sky and go through 1,000 different numbers, many of which just can't have anybody watching them, really, can they? And they're all showing either adverts or advertising programs for like Thompson's Holidays or something like that. Or there's a bingo channel or religious channels. And then a lot of the other ones are just showing repeat after repeat after repeat. It's buy it in cheap telly just to get some advertising revenue to keep yourself on air. It seems like a thoroughly pointless exercise with a lot of them. You can understand why a lot of those channels exist. You can understand why a channel exists for a holiday company, because it's where the customers can go to choose a holiday. Mm. You can understand why a religious channel exists, because, you know, for people who are, you know, very serious about that religion, they might want to stick on that channel and watch them. But some of these other channels that just show repeats with no new content whatsoever, and it's just about the advertising paying for the repeats, and the repeats getting just enough viewers to make the revenue worth it for the advertisers. It's like a non-stop cycle of absolute pointlessness.
It is. Have you not written a story about that yet? Oh, it's been done.
Do you know what, though? We live in an age where people will literally just have the television running in the background without them even watching it. So it doesn't matter what channel it's on. And now,
do you know what, Simon? Yeah, what? You say we live in an age, but that's how it's always been. You know, when there were only two channels, when there was only one channel. If you bought a television back in 1955, you turned it on and you just left it running. And whatever else you were doing, BBC was going on in the background. And sometimes you'd sit down and take notice of the programmes. And then other times you wouldn't. And oftentimes, even if you were sitting watching the telly, you'd be having a conversation and taking no notice of what's going on the screen. And this is why television has to be fairly simple, because it has to be comprehensible to somebody who's not watching it, which seems like a contradiction in terms, but it's not. You know exactly what I mean, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, this is true of all television. It has to be complicated enough that if you do give it your full attention, it rewards that, and simple enough so that if you're not giving it any attention, you can still follow what's happening.
So does this go along with the RTD idea of having really loud soundtrack music?
I tell you what, this is something a lot of people don't know. I'm not sure if I didn't bring this up last time, but it was on my mind too, and I don't think I actually did, so I'll bring it up now. You know how on a lot of television programs, there'll be a scene where somebody's in a dark room and they're shining a torch around, and you're sitting at home thinking, it's so light in that room, you can actually see everything without any need for a torch whatsoever.
Mm. Yeah.
You must recognise what I'm saying there.
Oh,
yeah?
I see it all the time. It bugs me a lot.
You know why? Because if somebody's sitting having a conversation and only paying half an attention to the television, if the screen goes any darker than that, they'll think there's something wrong with the telly or something wrong with the channel and change to a different channel.
Yeah.
It is stipulated in the BBC, or it used to be, I'm not sure whether it still is, it was stipulated in the BBC's rules and regulations that you had to have a certain amount of light on screen at all times, regardless.
Wow. I never knew that.
So, I mean, I don't know if that is still the case, but any program maker would be kind of stupid to have 2 minutes of an absolutely black screen, because you're going to lose half your viewers who are just going to say, oh, something's wrong with BBC One. Oh, that's all right, put ITV on.
Yeah.
Going back to the Jagra Fest.
I couldn't go that far.
Going back to the Jagra Fest being the monster in the ceiling, right?
Yeah.
The big problem with that, and do you know what? Some episodes, which aren't particularly good, if they end well, and if everything ties together nicely, you kind of forgive it the flaws, because the feeling that you're left with when you finish watching is one of satisfaction, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But in the case of the long game, you have got this situation whereby there's a mystery. You know, like many, many Doctor Who stories, there's a mystery. And you unfold the mystery, and when you get to the end of the mystery, like I say, it needs to resolve in a satisfying fashion. When you get to the end of the long game, okay, sure, you've got Simon Pegg as the sort of walking, talking, button-pressing mouthpiece for this mighty Jagra Fest, but you need to believe that this creature that Simon Pegg's character is beholden to is an intelligent, articulate creature. A creature that's capable of not just controlling Simon Pegg, but having established this entire regime of, you know, mind control by television. This creature needs to be super intelligent. And then they give us this thing on the ceiling that looks like it lives in the bottom of a swamp.
Well, maybe the idea is it was kind of like a Jabba the Hutt type character. I don't know.
But it doesn't fit, does it?
No, this was one of the gripes I had at the same, exactly the same thing. I was thinking, okay, you got the editor. If he had been the baddie, you kind of go, oh, okay, he's the villain. He's quite intelligent. And then you get a blob on the scene. You think, well, how does that work? We do get a bit more of an explanation later that the Daleks are involved in some shape or form, but it still doesn't. You know what really would've... Yeah, go on.
You know what would have really, really worked? If you'd have taken the Jagra Fest bits out altogether and just had that scene with the Doctor and with Simon Pegg's character, and then at the very, very end of the episode, Simon Pegg pegs it, and then instead of having the cliffhanger at the end of Bad Wolf, and the brilliant thing about the cliffhanger at the end of Bad Wolf isn't the fact that it's the Daleks that are there, but the fact that the Doctor says, Rose, I'm coming to get you. That's the brilliance of that cliffhanger. The Long Game is the episode right after Dalek. You've just seen the very last Dalek in the universe wiped out. Mm. By the time you get to Bad Wolf, you kind of know the Daleks are coming back for their end of season finale, right? Mm. Even if you've not heard rumours that the Daleks are coming back for the last two episodes, you can kind of feel it's on the cards, right? You can't feel on the cards is in the very next episode after Dalek, if Simon Pegg's character had pegged it, and then you'd cut away to two Daleks on a spaceship, and one of them says, "The editor is dead," and the other one says, "We had better put forwards plan B." No. And then you go into the final sting and the theme music, and the next week you're in London with Stephen Moffat's Empty Child. Or Father's Day or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
You're such a child of the 70s, aren't you?
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. Or you could have had the editor suddenly been within the gun sights of a Dalek. But yeah. They don't actually need to say it's a Dalek.
A cutaway to Daleks somewhere else, like in Mission to the Unknown, where you know that the Daleks are coming back and you've been given this teaser, but you don't know when. Mm. And the week after, you know, Dalek went out and you saw the very last Dalek in the universe dead, if you just had this 10 seconds of the Daleks in the very next episode, leading into four episodes in a row in which the Daleks don't appear, then you're on the edge of the seat every week wondering when the Daleks are actually going to turn up.
It's funny you mentioned Mission to the Unknown. I was thinking about that early on in the conversation. It was one of the first things that popped into my head before we started opening our mouths. I should have said it, really. But it does feel like that it's a... It plainly is that, actually, isn't it? It's a kind of a prologue.
Yeah, kind of.
But you're right. If you'd have just thrown the Daleks in there somewhere, even just a little bit, just the sound of them coming over the radio or something, that would have been quite chilling.
Yeah,
but actually seeing them, that would just be fantastic.
Simon Pegg is doing the thing like the... the character in Armageddon Factor, John Woodvine's character, where he goes to the mirror and starts talking to the mirror and you can't hear what's coming out of the mirror. Yeah. Simon Pegg does that and all you hear is boom, 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 boom.
Yeah,
you know, the Dalek sound effect.
Yeah. Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we'd have known, but the rest of the population. So we'd have known, the rest of the population wouldn't. So I think a little Dalek cameo would have been better after all.
I mean, in 2005, I was a massive Simon Pegg fan. I mean, he hadn't really broken it that big. He was a huge hero in my head because of Spaced.
And,
but not anymore.
But he's kind of broken through now, isn't he? He's big. He's big money. He's Star Trek. He's Scotty.
I thought he was a complete waste in that episode, though.
Well, I was thinking about that. I don't think you could fit him into Doctor Who now in the same way as you did then. Then that was kind of the right level of part for him.
You could have, if you were to put him in now, he'd have to have a significant part and he'd need to be acting a bit more instead of just pissing around, which is what he plainly does in that episode, I think. It doesn't really...
And in fact, that doesn't serve the episode very well either, really, does it?
No.
Whenever you stick somebody in who's got a very serious part and it's an actor that you can't take seriously, and this isn't always the fault of the viewer bringing their own preconceptions to it, but a lot of actors, and Simon Pegg is, for better or worse, one of these people. A lot of actors, as soon as the camera turns on, they're just playing themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. And Simon Pegg can't not do that. He's just one of those people who can't not do that. Mm. So even when he's trying to be deathly serious as this editor, this character who's actually dead, and he's been reanimated in order to, you know, provide these functions, you can't... Simon Pegg doesn't quite pull it off, does he?
He doesn't, but I tell you what, it was still a squee moment for me when I saw, because I'm the same as Simon, I'm a massive Pegg fan. So it's still kind of, Simon Pegg! It doesn't matter whether he wasn't that great in the episode or it wasn't a great episode. It was only in retrospect that we look back and go, yeah, he wasn't so good. But, you know, I think I was pretty much on a tide of just loving everything that was coming out of RTD at that point anyway. So if you look backwards, Simon Pegg couldn't do any wrong and it was fine.
It felt like it was another part of feeling that the right people were in control.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah exactly. Yeah.
I tell you, the absolute opposite of that was Tamsin What's-Her-Face as the nurse.
Oh, I love her. She's great.
Yeah, what's the surname?
Oh, Tamsin Gregg?
That's it. Because the part of the nurse isn't written to be a wholly serious part. No. And so she pulls that off for the plum because it's, you know, perfectly judged for what she can perform.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, the timing in it is beautiful. The fact that she's playing a very, you know, a delectable kind of nurse who's trying to sell you, basically, this little appendage in your head. just beautiful and quite chilling as well. Well, you know, obviously it's not massively chilling. She's not drilling holes in you and feeding you to a monster. But you kind of think, well, I'm going to trust her, but should I really? You know.
Well, she's very sardonic in the way she does it.
She's brilliant. Sardonic, that's a good word.
Mm. Let's not forget as well. Sorry, I get mixed up with these episodes. It was where we saw Adam get his comeuppance, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. That's probably the most
important part of that story, actually.
So yeah. Yes, in a way it is. There's kind of two things going on with that story, isn't there? One of them is it's setting up. And of course, this is a little bit like the Ark in Space and Revenge of the Sith, where you can use the same sets for two stories, but there's a much bigger connection between this and Bad Wolf. It's setting things up for Bad Wolf, and you don't realize that yet.
No.
So it needs to be self-contained, and it is self-contained. It just feels a bit loose. But if you watch the other episodes immediately afterwards, it doesn't feel quite as loose as it does, but it still does feel loose. And the other thing is, it's not just a start for the finale, but it's also the end for this sort of two-episode Adam arc. I think that would have worked better if there'd been another story in between where he kind of performs but doesn't quite. We needed to see him on the ground before we see him get his comeuppance. Mm. Do you think?
Yeah. I mean, we know that a lot of things were moving quickly through those seasons. I'm not going to jump too far ahead and go into detail, but, you know, Boomtown's a good example when you realise Jack's been on the ship for a while. But you know,
you needed a Boomtown for Adam, really, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that's right. It did. It just needed that kind of middle story to bed him in, and then for us to kind of slowly grow to not like him that much and think, oh, we should go, and then he goes. you know, we kind of second guess it as well. So that would have been quite nice.
And this is one of the problems with Russell T. Davis sometimes. But wow, this is a problem with writing, because when you're writing, you're so close to something and you spend so much time on it that you kind of get the idea in your head that the audience has that much time as well. But it's almost a case that the writer feels that character's been in the story for longer than he has, probably because the writer spent weeks writing it. And you just can't see the 45 minutes then. You're just too close to it to see the 45 minutes. And it's because it feels entirely perfunctory that they introduce a character to get rid of him. It's like, here he is, and then the next week, there he goes. There's nothing in between. It's just straight from here he is to there he goes. Mm. You really, really needed to find out a little bit more about that character. Because the other thing is as well, when he goes, it should be a shock and a shame to say goodbye to him so soon. It should be a shock and a shame that he is that duplicitous that the Doctor feels it necessary to get rid of him so quickly. But in order for it to feel a shame, you have to have empathy for the character, and you just don't get it. Because it's just not enough time to build it.
There's kind of a Willy Wonka element to the Doctor's behaviour with him, though. Because I think it's got more to do with Rose than it's ever got to do with Adam. Adam is just a pawn, you know. The Doctor sees Rose say, "Oh, come on, come along," and the Doctor sort of says, "Are you sure?" And he's kind of letting her make her own mistakes, which is why you get a very quick turnaround on that. That yeah, she learns very quickly that she's picked the wrong person, and you know, it's that old.
Well,
with great power comes great responsibility. You know, you don't just let anyone on the TARDIS, and he's kind of teaching her. More than anything, that's how I feel about it anyway.
But there's also, I suppose, there's also a little bit of this you fancy me thing. Oh, and now you fancy him? Right, I'll show you about him.
Yeah.
But then, of course, all that is undone when 2 weeks later, Captain Jack turns up. And, you know, this is quite famous that Russell T. Davis rewrites just about everybody else apart from Stephen Moffat. And you perhaps don't notice it unless you sit and think about it, but the Stephen Moffat episodes are always at odds with what Russell T. Davis is doing. It's really obvious in The Girl in the Fireplace when it comes the week after school reunion, and at the end of school reunion, Rose is pissed off that Mickey's coming along in the TARDIS, and then The Girl in the Fireplace, she's fine with it. And in school reunion, Rose is so jealous that the Doctor had this previous relationship with Sarah Jane Smith, and then the following week he's fallen in love with Madame de Pompadour and she doesn't really give two figs. And yet here we are in series one, and you've got the Doctor in Rose, that very first episode, behaving like a shy schoolboy trying to chat up the girl when he's asking her to come along with him in the TARDIS at the end. And throughout the first half of the series, there's this kind of... It's not quite a will-they-won't-they thing in the sort of same way as it would have been in something like Moonlighting, for example. It's not quite that, but it's in that area. There's definitely a feel that the audience are rooting for Rose to get her man. And so, in Dalek, it feels slightly odd that she should go off and start fancying somebody else. And then in the long game, that's compounded by the fact that this guy proves himself to be a waste of space and the Doctor gets rid of him. And the audience is thinking, that's right, because Rose and the Doctor belong together after all. And then 2 weeks later, she's swanning off after Captain Jack and the Doctor doesn't care.
It doesn't do Rose any favours. You get the impression she's just this fickle, just out of school child who blows hot and cold.
Which is fair enough, because she's supposed to be a teenager, but you need to write it consistently. The Adam thing is consistent with the character. The Captain Jack thing isn't.
No,
that's right. And actually, in Father's Day before that, the Doctor has a right old go and leaves on Earth. They have a big party and he walks away.
Yeah.
So it's...
Oh, he'd never have gone, though.
No, he would never have gone. I wouldn't have done.
No, you know damn well he wouldn't have gone. But nevertheless, right, at the risk of spending the entire episode talking about the long game, I think we should move on.
I know, let's go.
I
was going to say, we have talked about it for a long time, but it is testament to the fact that it is an episode which is kind of a bit of a transition episode between, you know, it's just juggling things a bit. It's a bridge between the landmark episodes in some respects. So,
well, there's a lot going on in the long game.
Yeah.
And that's perhaps another reason why it doesn't quite feel fulfilling, because there's so much going on in the long game that has to do with something else, somewhere else.
Mm, absolutely.
That it's not a self-contained plot, but it's an entirely unself-contained story. It's not like in the days of, say, the X-Files, where the first and last episode in each series would have to do with an arc, and then all the episodes in the middle could be juggled into any order, any order whatsoever, and it wouldn't make any difference. You know, it's brilliant to write a series in which the episodes have to take place in that particular order, because you are telling a very definite story across those episodes. But in the case of something like The Long Game, unfortunately, the episode suffers from being too much about something else than it is about itself.
Mm.
Right, I'm going to read an email, because we said we were going to try and make this a 60-minute episode, and we're already at half an hour or more just on one episode.
Hey.
Okay, we've got three longer emails and a bunch of shorter ones about Series 1, and as we're going to have a guest next week or the week after for the second half of this podcast, I'm going to read all the messages out today, whether they're about the stories we're talking about or not. So I'm going to do the short ones now, and then we'll have the three longer ones in between the other stories we talk about. Chris Hodgen says, the direction and visual design is not as sophisticated as in later series, but all the stories are good, and I think it is still the most satisfying series arcs. Since the series came back, the most satisfying series arc that we've seen. Kieran Hyman says, I saw this season upon first Australian broadcast when I was 6. Oh, this should fit in nicely with Finley.
Yeah. Okay.
He says, I would also like to take this time to refute the myth that all people of my age must have been introduced to Doctor Who via Eccleston's or Tennant's Doctor and don't know what classic Doctor Who is. In fact, I was lucky enough to experience the entire classic era in order over 3 years, beginning a whole year, 8 months and 6 days before seeing Rose.
Wow.
And then he finally says about Series 1, good season though.
Mm. Nice to have you on board.
Justin Watson says, my top four choices I loved, really great, emotionally investable stories. The final six choices are indicative of the reasons I didn't watch every episode of Series 1 on original transmission. All gimmick, flying Daleks, silly Auton plastic effects, daft aliens, farting noises, riffs on current, dated and dumb game shows, and little cohesion. Ties with the classic year here are mockeries for me. Oh, the ties with the classic years are mockeries for him. Although the rift in Boomtown paid off nicely in Torchwood. Not a great big fan then, Justin Watson. Tim Burrows says, upon being asked to put the episodes in order, what a tough ask this is. I feel sorry for numbers 7 to 10, ranking them so poorly. They're all good. And there really isn't a lot between 2 to 10, with The Empty Child being the standout for the series. And finally, from the short ones, Richard Judge says, the best Doctor Who season of all time. Not one bad story and 6 all-time classics. So there you go.
A lot of love for that.
I think Series 1 is one of those... there are a few people who didn't take very well to it, but I think most people who like any modern Doctor Who have got a lot of time for Series 1 because it really hit the ground running and it really felt coherent as well, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a surprise around every corner as well. You know, you say coherent, it was. It had a feel and a tone to it. But there was always a surprise. I mean, I'm never going to forget. No, maybe we'll get there. But the space pig was the thing for me. That was the moment.
Oh, no, we're getting there. Because yeah, that's the story that's up next.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Aliens of London is the one that came in 9.
No.
But Lee's absolutely right. The space pig.
The space pig was it. That was the moment. That was the epiphany moment for me. When I just sat there and went, this can go anywhere. And do you know what? I don't care. Do it. Just hit me, RTD.
And do you know what was so brilliant about the space pig? He goes around to the hospital and he goes into the hospital and we all know there's something in there. It could be anything. And you're thinking, right, Doctor Who is about to get into alien territory.
Mm.
You know, these people are trapped, but, you know, these people are inside this hospital and there's something in there with them. And anything could, bloody hell, is that a pig in a costume?
It's genius.
But the brilliant thing about that is not the fact that you go, bloody hell, is that a pig in a costume? But that 10 minutes later, you're crying your bloody eyes out for the pig.
Yeah.
And then 5 minutes after that, you find out why the pig was there in the first place when it's revealed about the plot that the Slitheen have set up to get all these characters together so they can do away with them all. They just made this, augmented this pig's brain and just set it off to be killed, sent it off to the slaughter. So you're not crying for it once, but you're crying for it twice. Not actually crying, but you know what I mean? You go straight from bloody hell, it's a pig in a costume to absolute pathos. How is that not brilliant?
It was, and you're right about we weren't crying our eyes out, but I really did feel for that pig. It was played so well. Christopher Eccleston, I think that was one of his first scenes, wasn't it, or something?
But well, his very first scene.
Very first scene. It was played just to a T. It was so perfect because he played it so seriously, you know, as if he was meeting a being for the first time. It was lovely. The whole thing was perfect. And then the army comes in, and you know what Christopher Eccleston, the Doctor, feels about the army, and they shoot the pig, and then he takes control, and you think, yeah, this guy kicks big fat butt. He's a brilliant Doctor from that point forward anyway. He was great from the opening shots, but... From that period, I just thought, oh, Doctor Who is back. We've got it, and we've got a really different version of it. I'm happy. I'm happy for it to go mental and strange and stupid and farty. I don't care what people say.
And what I loved about that was because that whole episode, you couldn't predict from 1 minute to the next. You know,
no,
an alien spaceship crashes into London, and what does the Doctor do? He sits down to watch it on the telly.
Yeah.
And then the aliens get into Downing Street. And you're thinking, right, time for their plan to kick into action. And what do? They sit around laughing about the fact that they've made it as far as Downing Street. which is a shock, a huge shock. But it's also really realistic. As silly and as daft and as cartoony as that episode is.
Yeah.
Also, in spite of the jokes and the catchphrases and everything else, you look at the motivations of the characters, and the characters are really well drawn. They might talk in kind of Scooby-Doo type funny language, but at the back of everything they're saying, you're actually thinking, yeah, this is not implausible.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, it could be a carry-on Doctor, couldn't it? It could have turned into that. but it didn't. You know, there was enough darkness in there. The fact that, you know, there's somebody hiding in the cupboard watching somebody get skinned. I mean, you don't see it, but you know what's going on. It's pretty horrific, really. The fact that the comedy element is that they put a zip on somebody's head when they climb in and out of the suit of a person, which is really funny. That means the kids find it funny. They get it. They can pretend to be Slytherins at school. They can point to their teachers and go, "I bet he's got a zip under that wig." And it's just perfect for the kids. But at the same time, there's enough grotesqueness and deviousness in the characters for the adults to kind of enjoy as well. Yeah, that was the point when I was going into my workplace and people were talking about Doctor Who as if it was their show. And I was standing there going, "Hang on a minute. Yeah. This is my show."
Yeah. There are a couple of things that spoil it. And one of them is a pretty serious thing.
CGI?
I have to say, no. Okay. There are two things that spoil it. One is the issue of pacing.
It's
a two-parter. Yeah. It's the first two-parter, and they're not quite sure how to do it. So the first 40 minutes of the first half of the episode is 20 minutes of old Doctor Who stretched out to double its length. Which is okay, because they fill in the time nicely. But having said that, you know, when you get to see Christopher Eccleston, spaceships come down, I'm going to sit and watch it on telly. That is kind of an odd move, and while I kind of like the oddness of the move, we stay with that for probably too long. And then you've got him doing things that are entirely illogical just in order to make sure the plot is spaced out enough. Like when he gets in the TARDIS and goes to the hospital, he makes sure Rose stays behind. Why does he do that? It doesn't make any sense. He does that because Russell T. Davies has got 40 minutes to fill, you know, purely and simply. And then you've got... The cliffhanger is 5 minutes long. It's okay. It's okay that you've got the same cliffhanger three times over. You know, some stories from the classic series would give you three different Jeopardies at the cliffhanger, and you can't wait to find out what happens because everybody's in trouble. In Aliens of London, everybody's in the trouble, but they're all in the same trouble. Which is, and of course, that's 5 minutes at the end of the episode. And in the second of the episodes, they're racing through it to sort of... But at the same time as they're racing through it, also, because he knows he's only got 45 minutes to wrap it up, he kind of underplots it. So in spite of the fact that they're racing through it, nothing really happens in the second episode. Everybody's in Downing Street, and Mickey, you know, goes to his computer and drops a bomb on them. That's as much plot as there is in the second episode.
That is ridiculous, that part, but it is quite funny. That's when it goes into Sarah Jane land, doesn't it? When you look at the Sarah Jane episodes afterwards, you think, this would have worked quite nicely in Sarah Jane. That's why the Slytherin worked so well, because the kids love them. But
I hated that when I first saw it. But, you know, when I first saw it, I loved the first episode and hated the second. Yeah. But now... There is actually so much good stuff in the second episode that you forgive it, those problems. All those conversations with Margaret Slytherin and stuff, which is why they brought her back from Boomtown.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got Jackie, for goodness sake, shouting Slykeen at everybody.
and of course, you've got Penelope Wilton as well.
Oh, yeah.
And there's some great cast as the Slytherin and as the government officials. You know, the guy here... I can't remember the actor's name. The one who gets bumped off at half time. The sort of government official who gets bumped off when the Slytherin finally get into Downing Street and start killing people. And he's actually a pretty well-known actor at the time who'd just been the lead in something on Channel 4 across about 4 or 5 weeks. And I'm thinking, they've got this guy for Doctor Who. Brilliant. He'll be like the main star of this episode. Oh, he's dead.
That was nice, yeah.
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 But the thing that really spoiled Aliens of London, the second part, World War III, is the fact that when it comes down to it, how do you get rid of the alien menace? Drop a bomb on it.
Yeah, but do you know what the nice twist was? Is that you drop a bomb on the Doctor as well, and Rose. And that was. I quite like that kind of, that little chat with Jackie, you know, that she's like, "Look, can you promise me she's going to be all right?" And he's like, "Well, you know, he can't actually, and it's up to her to make this choice. But if she doesn't, then the world's buggered." And you know, that was a really good scene. I don't, not enough is said about that scene, I don't think. The actual decision-making part of it. There may have been a few holes there. He probably could have done other things. But, you know, tension-wise, that was a great idea. And the fact that they get blasted out of number 10, they completely flatten it and they all jump out of a little box is very amusing. It's a bit like the A-Team, yeah. Isn't it, when they crash in a van and it'll come out okay.
Well, like Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
I like it when Doctor Who's like Scooby. Yeah, I agree with you. I think what they do with it, once they've made the decision to do that, is brilliant. But I still think that is a very questionable decision to do that in the first place. And I'm sure if they'd have done something else, they'd have done equally brilliant things. But I'm not saying I dislike it because of that. You know, I accept that they went with that decision and I enjoy the constituent parts. But it will always be slightly troubling that your first big two-parter in the new series, and instead of taking the opportunity to show the Doctor doing something really clever and really interesting, what you do instead is just drop a bomb on the aliens.
I'm always a little bit cynical when people say, oh, that's just aimed at kids. But actually, I think that story is pretty much aimed at kids.
I think it's aimed at in there for the grown-ups.
Well, when they operate well, it works on multiple levels. But usually there's a blending, but there are definitely sort of levels to that story. There is an adult level, but there are also children. I mean, yeah, farting aliens. I know you've been through all this because I wasn't around for the Crap Monsters 2 podcast, but yeah,
they're not farting.
But it is aimed at. It's aimed at the Horrible Histories crowd. And the kids love that. I think you mentioned in the podcast, I listened to it early today because I do my homework, unlikely. And, and you know, they would go to school the next day and say about that, you know, the fact that... And there's also that thing of, you know, if you hear one of your teachers fart, you could say, oh, they're a Slitheen. But you've also got, if you're afraid of it, you've got this simple answer, which is you chuck vinegar over them. That's aimed at the children as well.
It's genius.
Yeah.
It's genius.
You know, if a child starts having nightmares,
is the science
they
right?
Just have a bottle of vinegar next.
Yeah, is the science correct, though, with that? You know, if you threw vinegar over a being that was made out of, what were they made out of? Chalk, basically.
Or something.
Yeah, they're going to explode.
Right.
Well, well, that's the point, Lee, isn't it? It doesn't need to be correct, because we don't know...
No, this isn't Star Trek.
We don't know the specific constitution of them, do we? It's silly. I love it when Doctor Who's silly. I don't mind a bit of silly at all.
And
as long as it's got the other stuff, and Aliens of London has the other stuff as well in spades.
It does. And I'm really perplexed as to why it's so low. It's a real surprise to me.
Actually, that scene where they're on top of the building and then the ship goes over the top of them is probably one of the most iconic scenes ever in Doctor Who.
It
for
is
me.
Now. Yeah.
It's a shame that they had to mirror the image when it hit Big Ben.
Yeah,
but that was pretty impressive, wasn't it? Even though it was backwards.
Oh, it's just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. But it chills down the spine when I saw that.
It was.
And using real news reports with real news readers from the TV at the time just made me feel like, oh my gosh, everybody's really accepting Doctor Who again. They're really going for it. The BBC completely believes in it. Everybody's a fan making it. It's going out there and people are enjoying it and loving it. No longer can you hide. Do you have to hide your Doctor Who magazine in a paper bag? You can walk out proudly with it because... other people are buying it that aren't Doctor Who fans. And it was just a very strange period. So that you're right, that as soon as that spaceship hits Big Ben, the pig, Big Ben, so many fantastic moments in those episodes. Why is it number 2 at the bottom? What's the matter with people?
I don't know. You know that first episode, that entire 40-odd minutes that it was on, every single second you didn't know what was coming up next.
No.
Doctor Who lost that after that. But just for that... start of series one, or for the whole of series one, it was like that every week. You never knew what was coming next.
No, do you know what? We got so used to it being a little bit more serious, not serious, but it was taking itself a bit more seriously as it was going along. When the Adipose came along, which would have suited perfectly in this first season, I remember myself thinking, oh, that's a bit childish. And in fact, there's me loving the Slitheen episode. Matt Smith era, we would never get the Slitheen now, would we?
Let's not forget as well, this series, they're still banging the tent pegs in. They're still...
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
Reintroducing introducing it to a whole new audience. Yeah. And
Right, shall we move on to another email?
Yes.
Because, yeah. Okay, Jim Hall says, from Eccleston's slow-motion boots wobbling away from a fireball in the preview teasers to the Dalek-flavoured Armageddon promised by the finale trailer, the 2005 series is the only time I can remember Doctor Who surpassing my expectations rather than leaving me thinking it's not as good as it used to be. Sweeping away the zany boffin mode of Doctor in favour of a no-nonsense firebrand, introduced to his travelling companion by blowing her job to bits, got to the nub of what the Doctor as a character is about, once stripped of fancy dress and affectations. You could almost imagine this being how Hartnell's Doctor might have started out. An amazing run of stories, with RTD expertly cherry-picking the very best and most striking concepts from the show's history across various media to convince an audience who'd normally avoid dweeby shows like The Plague that this time they'd be idiots to miss out. He then goes on and has a couple of words about two stories in particular. He says, even if The Parting of the Ways left me disappointed at the time, mostly due to the was that it bad wolf revelation and magic powers solution, seen now, it's an astonishing episode, bleak and relentless, where even minor characters are built up so that their deaths floor you. The Doctor's defeated body language immediately after tricking Rose to safety in the TARDIS, and later his near-as-damn-it abdication from being the Doctor when faced with the Dalek Emperor's pinpoint taunts. This feels as though it really could be the final end. And then he says, a special word about Aliens of London, which I'm guessing few others will place as highly as I have. For me, it's a bang-on piece of writing, combining a willfully daft monster runabout with a genuinely affecting dramatic thread about the consequences Rose's travels have for those left behind, with Jackie at least considering that she'll never see her daughter alive again and Mickey's life in ruins. Yet people forget about this in a boring rush to moan about farting aliens as if the show has no business throwing a bone to youngsters who might not be so awed by a domestic tragedy. While the preceding episodes did a fantastic job of introducing most of the show's core concepts to a new audience, this one firmly established that the series was heading into a whole new direction, a drama anyone can engage with while simultaneously enjoying the brilliantly lunatic window dressing.
That's a great email.
Fantastic.
What was the name of that person?
That was from Jim Hall.
Thank you, Jim Hall. You're going to get some Jelly Baby show like slithing come through the post. Well done for putting it so high up there on a postal.
I think we should send him one of our brand new Blue Box podcast mugs.
Right, eh?
What?
We should send him one of our brand new Blue Box podcast mugs.
So that's what, a photocopy, is it, of your face on a mug?
And if there was any such thing as a brand new Blue Box podcast mug, I'd ask him for his address so you could send it to him. But there's no such thing. So he'll just have to deal with your jelly babies. Okay, the story that came 8th out of the 10 stories in series 1. Do you like to guess?
Oh, I would say the end of the world.
No, I
the end of the world, really?
Yeah, really.
You think that's going to be in the bottom half?
Yeah. Oh, plenty.
Simon, what would you say?
Well, I hope not end of the world, because I think I voted it very highly. it could be the other Slitheen. It could be Boomtown.
It is the other Slitheen.
Oh, right. Okay.
Boomtown.
Mm. There's a trend here.
Boomtown, though, is utterly fantastic.
I love Boomtown.
Apart from the Deus Ex Machina at the end.
Yes.
It's like... this will be my only complaint about it. I can go with Russell T. Davis setting up this big debate and not answering it. Because I think as a writer, sometimes it's more important to put the question out there than it is necessarily to tell the world what you think the answer is. Because any political, with a small p, debate, there is no answer. It's all shades of grey. If two people are on opposite sides of the table, the answer is somewhere in between them. It's not at one end of the table or the other. So if Russell T. Davis had decided this story by giving us his answer to it, that would probably have made it a lesser episode. However, by resolving the episode by having Margaret Slitheen open the TARDIS and turn into a baby, what?
Mm.
You know, total Deus Ex Machina. Yeah. Doesn't really have any place in being there. And the only reason he's put it there is so that when Rose does exactly the same thing two episodes later. Instead of being a Deus Ex Machina, it's a Chekhov's gun instead.
Hey!
But, right, I'll get off that subject now.
Season one, and Chekhov's gun.
Yeah. But, you know, apart from that, the rest of the episode is absolutely brilliant.
It really is. And you get a whole of that Cardiff area in it. It's beautiful. We've all been up there. And it's just a most amazing place anyway, Cardiff Bay. But they make no bones about just setting it right in Cardiff Bay. It's Cardiff. It's got, you know, a split in time, all that business used for Torchwood. Lovely, lovely. But the fact is, they're just sitting there chatting in a restaurant for most of it, or part of it. And I adore it for that. I also adore the bit where the, you know, when we first see the companions all high-five each other and Mickey goes, oh, God, look at you. It's a brilliant kind of feeling that a lot of people watching the telly would probably feel like, oh, this is getting a bit sickly. They're all a little bit kind of, you know, pally with each other. And we're kind of a bit like Mickey on the outside going, it's a bit sickly now.
Oh, and
so beautifully done.
What a piece of dialogue is, she's climbing out the window, isn't she?
Yeah.
That was one of my favourite moments from the entire first series, I think.
Oh, this is genius. And the running away bit was just comedy gold for me.
Yeah, but then, you know, some people are not going to like episodes because they've got stuff like that in them. And, you know, those people have got no soul and no heart, so
I like Charlie Chaplin, so, you know, there you go. That's my sense of humour.
Simon, Boomtown.
Do you know what? I'm going to have to be sketchy about it, because I can't actually remember watching it again since it was first on. Isn't that
Lee,
odd?
Boomtown.
No, it's strange, though, isn't it? I haven't been inspired to watch it again, but I must do. It's probably far more subtle than I would
think. We know you, Simon. I think you're going to come away from that going, oh, why didn't I watch that before talking to this podcast?
I watched it in fast forward because we're back to the old question of Margaret Sladeen's... What's the lady called who played
Margaret Sladeen's Lala?
Annette Badland.
Yes.
Annette Badland.
Annette.
Oh, yeah, we got
Annette, who gave us a hat to auction at the convention we did, and we...
You still can't work out when she
was. It was in Doctor Who. We can't find it anywhere.
No.
So I did watch Boomtown in Fast Forward.
Oh, rubbish.
I know.
Yeah, but she was also in World War III, don't forget.
Yes, of course. Yeah, no, I went through those, actually.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Look, Boomtown is everything we've just said about Aliens of London. The surprises, the adult stuff, the kids stuff, the stuff that in the playground kind of... The stuff that you can reenact in the playground, all that running about, you can do that in the playground. And I tell you what, if there's 20 minutes of that episode where the kids might be getting bored, all it takes is for Margaret Sladeen to send a little dart out of her fingertip at the doctor and for him to catch it. And, you know, they're excited again. And the bit at the start of the episode, well, not right at the start, but what is it, 10, 15 minutes in maybe, where Blythe Droog.
Yeah.
I mean, kids watching that, the hairs on the back of my neck were standing up. I can't imagine how that would have felt if I'd have been eight.
Mm. I mean, you do think, don't you, that if the budget was bigger and there's more stuff, they could have made it a bigger budgeted looking episode with extra stuff going on. Maybe could have got to the point where she really did have the nuclear power plant built or whatever. And you know, you're getting to the point where it could be like a Claws of Axos thing where it's getting to critical mass and all that. You know, you could have had all that, but you know what? I'm glad they didn't. It was great stripped back episode. It was the cheap episode, I think, wasn't it? One of the cheap episodes of that season.
Yeah.
And they did it justice. And they also had the brilliant thing of making the Doctor not answer for his crimes, but, you know, he's the responsibility of what he does. Obviously, that's been kicked out of the park a little bit now, but that was a great episode. It addressed a very thorny issue that RTD was brilliant at doing, actually. And through dialogue, he solved a lot of, you know, the kind of problems and issues that were going on.
Well, like I said, I kind of disagree a little bit there, in that I think that's only an issue of the screenwriter's making, because the Doctor's always fought evil. So you don't need an excuse for fighting evil. If it's evil, you fight it. So, you know, it's kind of like...
Yeah, but she had...
Davis.
yeah, sorry, but she has this moment, doesn't she, where she doesn't kill somebody because they're pregnant or something. Is that right, if I remember?
So you feel
a bit of slithinity in her. See what I did there?
Hitchhiker's.
Yeah, very good. But vagonity, isn't it, they say in Hitchhiker's Guide. But no, you see this other side to her, and that's...
What you really mean is Raxacarico Salvatorianity.
I knew you were going to go there. I can't say anything now. Don't need to. You know where I'm going with it.
Yeah. But do you know what? I mean, yeah, fair enough that he does. But Russell T. Davis places that in that story. He doesn't pluck it from somewhere else.
No.
Okay. This needs addressing. He says, right, I need to address something. Okay, I'll address that. Mm. I don't think if he hadn't decided to do a story about whether the Slitheen were bad per se, or whether they were just bad by our standards, then he wouldn't have had to bring in the idea of whether the Doctor can also be bad by somebody's standards. Mm. Because I think by most people's standards, he doesn't do anything other than good deeds, essentially. Mm. So I think that's a bit of a straw man, really, isn't it?
I have got one issue with it. I think, talking about that little conversation they were having again, I think this happens now and again in Doctor Who, where the villain of the piece, or somebody who feels they know the Doctor, know him more than they should do as a character. So she's almost like saying, well, you're always like this. You do this all the time. You know, it's kind of, well, how do you know that? You only met him in the last episodes, a few episodes back. So how do you know he's always like this? And that is, you know, that's the writers putting that in, making us kind of go, yes, Doctor Who. But actually, if you think about the character, she's accusing him of quite a lot with only a few minutes of meeting him, really.
Oh, do you know what? I think we have found our least favourite episode of the series, haven't we?
Yeah, looks
not
like
because
it.
It's not brilliant, because there are more bits that aren't brilliant in this episode than there are in any of the others.
Okay, yeah, maybe, yeah.
Oh, shall we, seeing as we are like over an hour now and we've got two stories.
Useless, aren't
we? And we've got... Yeah, no, we have, for the next 60 minutes, we're going to be talking about part of what we're going to be talking about so that we can carry on talking about it for another half an hour after that. And I'm going to make both of you very happy and concomitantly very unhappy in the next 15 or 20 minutes when you find out what the next two stories are.
Okay.
But prior to that, I'm going to read another email, and then we've just got one left for the end of the episode. This one's quite a long one. Sean M. Vale, he gives us his 10 stories in order, and he tells us a little bit about each. Actually, he's done them 1 to 10, but I'm going to read it backwards so that we're going from 10 to 1, if you're both happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's his email backwards. Pigs and RTD with It Is Hell The What But. Unit with Up Hooks, He Till TV Watching Stuck Is Doctor The And Missing Bin Has Rose Where Part First The Like Die. London of Aliens 10. Snooze a off bit otherwise. Okay, I'm not going to keep this up for the entire email.
That's impressive.
But you must have been worried.
Yeah.
Okay, 10 Aliens of London. I liked the first part where Rose has been missing and the Doctor is stuck watching TV till he hooks up with Unit, but what the hell is it with RTD and pigs? 9 The Unquiet Dead. Best scene is when Rose steps into the snow, otherwise a bit of a snooze. 8 The Long Game. Oh, I can't read his first sentence. It is so rude. It is... Actually, I don't think it's a medical term. Okay, 8 The Long Game. Giant space clitoris. Simon Pegg was poorly used. 7 Bad Wolf. I don't have as much trouble with this being dated as some other fans do. As an American living in Asia, the only one of the game show... Are you still laughing about number 8?
That's ruined it for me forever.
Absolutely. Have you never seen The Last Torchwood?
Oh, God, yeah, you're right.
Anyway,
at least they found him in the end.
Back on the subject of Bad Wolf. As an American living in Asia, the only one of the game shows that I'd actually seen was The Weakest Link, and I thought that was quite clever and added a nice sense of tension. I also got to see Captain Jack without his clothes, so there's that. A really great cliffhanger, although the second part was a bit boring till Mickey saves the day with the big truck. Great regeneration. 6 The End of the World. Visually stunning, otherwise a bit of a non-offensive fluff to set the stage. Boomtown at number 5. Some great character moments and some lovely acting. Good comedy bits too. A nice way of showing the motivations and emotions of an established villain. A bit ham-fisted, but lots of fun to watch. 4. Father's Day. Good old-fashioned sci-fi tale told quite well, despite the shocking CGI. When the Doctor and Rose kept coming back to the same point in time, I was literally shouting, "What the hell do you think you're doing, Doctor?" I knew the series had changed once I saw that. In third place, The Empty Child. Scary, exciting, visually stunning. One of the few times that Doctor Who has actually given me a chill up my spine. The scene where Dr. Constantine transforms. Also, great use of creepy kids, something that always gives me nightmares. The introduction of the amazing Captain Jack is like the cherry on top. In second place, Dalek. A Dalek story on a par with Power of the Daleks, and never since replicated in any Dalek story. A great one, showing just how conniving and devious they can be, yet still making you feel just a bit of empathy for them. They're not evil robots, there's a being inside there. And then in first place, for Sean M. Vale, Rose. A perfect reintroduction of Doctor Who. Wonderful acting by the principal cast, some amazing writing, and enough humour to draw everybody in. A wonderful story letting us know how thick the Doctor can sometimes be, and why he needs a companion. I also really liked the idea that the Doctor has been noticed throughout time by the Nutters. And there you go, that's Sean M. Vale on the 10 stories from Series 1.
Mm.
And of those 10 stories from Series 1, Simon, what do you think came in?
Well, you inferred that we're both going to be gutted, so it's obviously both our favourite episodes. Therefore, I'm saying it's the end of the world.
As I've asked... Pardon?
End of the world?
It is the end of the world.
Mm, okay. Mm-hmm. I always root for the underdog anyway.
I don't think it's an underdog.
No, I don't think it is.
Do you know what? When it was first on, I thought, yeah, okay, that's a bit... Mm. I mean, it's nice and it sort of sets the scene for what the series can do. And, you know, later on in the series, we'll actually see what the series can do. But this is just setting the scene for it. But you know what? I probably watched it 3 times in that first week before the next episode was on. And your opinion doesn't really change because you've got nothing else to compare it to when you're rewatching it in the same week. But then I watched it again 6 months later in a rewatch of the entire series.
Mm.
And it was absolutely bloody brilliant. It doesn't set a single foot wrong throughout the entire 45 minutes, I don't think.
No.
That bit at the start where the spaceship comes in to land and it does a little dance and there's a bit of waltz on the soundtrack. What? Who the hell thought to put a bit of waltz on the soundtrack and have the spaceship actually dance to it? I mean, 2001 A Space Odyssey is one thing, but that was something entirely different. That was utterly mad and cheeky and wonderful and funny and beautiful and even slightly touching. And it was a 10-second special effect. That's how good the end of the world is. Right, over to you guys.
Do you want me to rant yet? Or not?
Well,
not
rant. You're going to rant positively, aren't you?
I'll enthuse. Okay, I'll tell you what. Go on, give yours.
I'll give mine because we've just had a very big positive. The end of the world isn't... It isn't the end of the world that it's that far behind because I genuinely like it. I do. But I always felt that it was 45 minutes of it being of the same pace all the way through. A kind of an amble, a walk, a little kind of, you know, it was designed to show Rose's reaction to aliens. It was to show you culture shock. It was to make it so alien it's absolutely unbelievable. And it was to see her reaction, how she would deal with it, whether she was good enough for the Doctor, that kind of thing. So on that level, it really works. There's a great moment where she's spinning a bit, the music's playing, she's looking around, she needs to get away. Just trying to remember, Tainted Love, wasn't it? Tainted Love?
Tainted Love, the first one, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure in Tainted Love it's like, you know, run away, and she kind of runs away. I'm sure it's that point anyway. And it really kind of works on that level.
Oh, no, Tainted Love was on much earlier. Or is it the other way around? No,
it's her first kind of moment of culture shock, I think, when it plays. I can't remember now anyway. But it does its job, yeah, but it doesn't really have the major kind of, oh, this is going to be really exciting, something amazing is going to happen.
It kind of ambles on
a bit, but it's nice. I really like it, but it is a bit Hitchhiker's meets Star Wars, which I think is why Simon likes it.
Steady, JR. I'm going to blow him out of the water in a minute.
I know.
Well,
I like it. Go on, then.
It's got the character, the guy, I can't remember his name, but the guy who greets the meet and greet.
Oh, yeah, he's quite
what
good.
An
the blue guy.
Astonishing performance. Yeah, yeah.
Every time I look at Cassandra now, all I can think about is that somebody uploaded a lasagna with her face on it, and it's on the Phonic Screwdriver website, and I can't stop thinking about the lasagna now, and it makes me hungry every time I look at Cassandra. There you go.
Wow. You know, Zoe Wanamaker as a pancake with a pancake that talks. Who thinks that stuff up? Isn't that just utterly, utterly amazing and wonderful and bizarre?
Do you know what would have made it even better? Because Zoe Wanamaker's got an intriguing shaped nose. What they just needed to put the nose on.
Should have had that.
That'd have been great.
They should have, actually. It was just a little nod to her, bless her. You know, and it'll make up for that whole career mistake of My Family.
I bet she was paid rather nicely for My Family, though. And
she must have. And Robert Lindsay as well. Absolutely. What on earth were they doing in that programme? Seriously.
They were giving it the only class it was going to get, probably.
Absolutely. Oh, God, it was bad.
Simon, you keep promising to blow Lee out of the water.
No, well,
not doing it.
No, well, I just think there's a lot more to see there than just the bits he's picked out. Because I just, as you say, it's so consistent. But I put it at number one. And I'm a bit
number
of an old...
One.
I'm a big softie at heart. And I just think it was the first Doctor Who I'd ever watched that moved me to any kind of emotive response. The nearest being probably Adric dying or something like that. But I got over that within about 10 minutes. As we all did. But I literally welled up watching that episode because it absolutely hit a nerve. You not only have you got the Rose thing where she gets some kind of perspective on the alien, and we're talking Douglas Adams alien. We're talking, oh my God, there's trees walking around. It is like something out of Hitchhiker's Guide. All these different
when
aliens.
When Jabe dies, what a moment of...
Yeah.
Again, absolute pathos.
Yes.
And to do it in the background the way they did, so it's so quiet and so subtle, and she was just there 1 minute and gone.
Yeah, yeah. And you
especially
got
to... as that was just nice Liana.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Where
yeah.
does this stuff come from? Whose brain does this come out of?
And what about Chris Ruckerson's performance when she says, you know, I'm so sorry, and touches him, and he wells up. We've never seen the Doctor cry before.
I'm going to interject. I absolutely agree with that. When the tear came down his face, I cried a little bit in my eyeball. And I was holding it back because my whole family was there. I think, oh, my God, I'm about to cry at Doctor Who.
Hang on, I'm watching Doctor Who. Why is this happening? What is going on? So you've got all of that. And then you've got by the end of it, you've got Rose's perspective on her time. And considering it's a TV series about everything, but one of the central things is about time travel, I don't think that time has ever been, and the Doctor's perspective on it and people's perspective on where they are in time has ever been addressed in that way. And all of this in the second episode of a brand new series. How brave is that?
Beautifully snapped back at the end when they go walking through town and she wants chips.
Yes.
You know,
Yeah,
I can see why you've put it so high. I understand how you work, you big soppy mush.
Well, speaking of snapping things back and tears, and speaking of Adric going, for those of us who are old enough, of course, when Adric died, we were actually so happy that there were tissues involved. Anyway.
Yeah, but there's just so much to like in it. And as you say, Zoe want to make it. And it's a murder mystery as well. And it's got a weird sort of 80s feel to it, especially when you've got the girl, the blue girl, who's, you know, going down the corridors and that. That is almost a McCoy era. I'll give it that. I'll give the McCoy era that. They can have that one.
All right. The end of the world may have come in seventh, but it is utterly, utterly wonderful. And the only reason it's come in seventh is because there are six stories above it that are equally as utterly, utterly wonderful.
Mm.
So we'll have one more email, and then we'll ask Lee what the last story is going to be. This, the last one we're going to talk about this week, the one that came in sixth. This is from Sean Quinn. He says, his memory of the series, excitement building from around New Year's Day, getting the tease of the TARDIS, the Radio Times counting down week by week, just seeing it mentioned on the cover all during the run because of weekly articles was thrilling and led me to begin keeping scrapbooks of all the Radio Times articles and listings. The trailer, the billboards and the teasers all week of the finale, and then a season trailer after the finale. Just a fantastic 2005 and a fantastic rebirth of our favourite show. And just going with gut reaction, very difficult as the thrill of Doctor Who being back on telly was so strong, here are his top five stories. In first place, Bad Wolf. Cried like a baby at the end. Whole series made me proud to be a fan, and even prouder that we, the family, watched the episodes, the entire series, together at the transmitted time. The godlike knowledge I was able to bestow upon my son. For example, that sound means Rose is on the Dalek ship upon hearing the control room heartbeat from Dalek episodes of yore. Spoilers. In second place, The Empty Child. It was just joyous. Everybody lives. In fourth place, Dalek. He didn't say anything about third place. I've skipped past that. In fourth place, Dalek. Just seeing a Cyberman's head alone made me love this. And in fifth place, The Unquiet Dead. The image of the old lady coming at you, leading into the titles, is embedded in my head forever. And on that note, Lee, would you like to guess which story came in sixth?
Before you even got there, I was thinking Unquiet Dead. So is it Unquiet Dead?
It is The Unquiet Dead.
Yeah. Yeah, I think...
Isn't it glorious?
It's amazing little piece of filming that is. That episode is wonderful. From start to finish, it's a beautiful little package episode. But that it is slightly empty in places. That's the only negative thing I've got about it. It is like, the cream on the top of a cappuccino should be scraped off a little bit there. That's a crap analogy, isn't it? But do you know what I mean?
It's no better or worse than we may have expected from you, Lee.
Than any other
Thank
ones.
You very much.
I didn't use the trifle. If I remember right, Mark Gatiss was a little bit disappointed. It became a runaround and a romp. He wanted to make it darker. I understand what he was wanting to do, and it would have been great dark. But actually, you know, it worked well enough because my son, I've said this three or four times through the podcast, I suppose, my son became petrified of eyes that were wide in anything on television after that. Gollum freaked him out. Anything with wide eyes completely scared the hell out of him.
I had the same thing with Michael Jackson's Thriller. I couldn't watch that video because of those eyes.
He can't watch it either.
No.
But it's not for his eyes.
Issues with Michael Jackson,
because he's rubbish. But... Yeah, no, you're
Michael
right. The eyes. Yeah. You know, it was all about that. So that, and he was five, I think six, and that was it. It frightened him away completely. So he didn't watch it with me, that one. That was a very odd situation. But anyway, the actual episode itself, a great idea, lots of tension building, lots of interesting things that were being laid down, you know, about the Time Lord wiping out, you know, what happened in the Time War to wipe out a whole planet. And him feeling sorry for the Gelth and siding with the Gelth and saying to the humans, what's wrong with having them use your dead bodies? And all this kind of... This is beautiful. It showed how alien he was. And of course, you know, it threw you back in time in that fantastic moment with Rose walking into the snow. But I'm not going to spoil it for you guys. I'm sure you've got lots to say as well. But and it's got Dickens in it, for God's sake. Simon Callow. Fantastic.
You're not spoiling it for us, Lee.
I can't help myself.
It's your episode.
I love it. I love it. It's great.
I've been promising for the last few weeks that I'm going to talk less.
No, but really, it is. It is fantastic. There are things missing. It does feel a little bit empty. It's a bit of a runaround.
I don't know. Do you think there are things missing?
It could have been darker. It could have been a little bit more full. You have got Dickens. You have got Dickens in it. I mean, you could have used it a little bit more... It's fine. It's great. It runs.
It was plenty dark enough for the humour, because there's a fair bit of humour in it, especially at the start where the body gets up and starts walking and you're expecting absolute horror, but instead Mr. Sneed there just says, oh my God, not another one.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that was great. That's some good
I mean, if there hadn't been enough of those already across the previous 2 weeks and weren't going to be more of those, that's one of those moments where you just stare at the telly with your jaw hanging off the top of your chest and a little light bulb going off on the top of your head going, only in Doctor Who. Mm,
but beautifully explained. The best zombie explanation in any fiction I've come across in a long time. That, you know, the gaseous forms inhabiting bodies of dead humans because they've got nowhere else to go. Just a brilliant idea.
And you know what's equally brilliant? And I think this escapes a lot of people. And I'm not sure it does, but it's something that never seems to be mentioned, is that, and you know, this has been a constant complaint about the first series, is that the Doctor doesn't do anything. You know, everything's always solved by other people.
Yeah.
And in this instance, you know, what I was about to say was, it is Charles Dickens who works out for himself that something to do with the gas. So by flooding the room with gas, he can somehow manage to sort of extricate the bodies from the beings inside them and then blow it up and solve it all, come to the resolution. It's Dickens who saves the day. But because the Doctor's influence, the same as with Kathaka in The Long Game, and the same with Rose in the very first episode, it's the Doctor who inspires these characters into saving the day. And of course, people forget that he did save the day in the end of the world, so it wasn't as if it was already becoming a thing by this point that the Doctor doesn't save the day. But I'm just saying, at the end of The Unquiet Dead, that's another one of those instances where people either point to it and say, oh, the Doctor doesn't save the day, but nobody points to it and says how brilliant that you write a story about Charles Dickens and then show how brilliant he is by showing him working out what he needs to do to save the day in a way that feels entirely proper for the story and entirely proper for the character. It's a brilliant piece of writing.
In the first seasons of Doctor Who with William Hartnell, he didn't always solve the answers, did he?
He very often didn't.
No,
in history.
No, exactly. So it shouldn't really make that much difference who does it, as long as the storytelling's good.
He facilitated the adventure. He didn't kind of.
No.
Yeah. Mm. It's another amazing thing. Was it third episode? Black humour. When was it? 6:45 in the evening?
Yeah, it's early.
Yeah, that's what makes the sort of gruesomeness really gruesome, is the fact that you have a sense of humour about it. Because if it had been, if you'd had all the darkness without the light, then, you know, it would just have been boring. It would have, not necessarily boring, it would have existed on one note.
Mm.
To give the light so that you can have the darkness with the light, and especially where the filter through which the darkness and the light join is humour, and black dark humour as well, is utterly brilliant. And to have moments like, not just when Rose takes her first step into history, it's like, okay, she's been on an alien spaceship encircling the Earth in the far future, right? But how much weirder it is to go back into history. And do you know why? Mm. Because we're all pointing at the future. Every day we live is another day into the future. But none of us can go backwards. You can't turn around. And so it becomes more of a thing for Rose to have turned around and gone backwards than it is to go forwards.
But what I also like is that, you know, he's essentially taken a 19-year-old chav back to meet Charles Dickens, right? You know, we have to presume that she probably studied a bit at school and got bored of it, or was never that interested in, or something. The fact is that this character is already developing right in front of her eyes. She's finding things interesting. She's learning from the Doctor about how important these people are, how great they are, how enthusiastic he is. He's like a child when he goes, oh, it's Charles Dickens, or, you know, and he's excited even in the carriage when there's no one to impress but Charles Dickens. And
of course that rubs just off on the audience.
It
too
does, yeah. So a lot of kids I know went, but the first thing they went to see to read was The Christmas Carol. I work in a library. Mm. So when they were coming and talking to me about it, I go, you've got to read this book. This is really, it's got ghosts in it. You'll love it. So there they were, taking it out, nearly in the middle of summer, Christmas Carol. but yeah, that was all due to Doctor Who. Thank you very much.
Shimon.
Shimon.
Yeah, well, as I say, well, it's another one where the kids all love, isn't it? You know, I mean, they all think old people are dead anyway. So when, you know, grandma's walking around again, it's they absolutely love that, aren't they? Oh, they get completely freaked out by it. I mean, it really was that scary. First shot, it was, which was stuck on the end of the tail end of the End of the World, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Even that was just like, oh, and I remember watching that with my ex-girlfriend and her saying, oh, I don't think my daughter's going to be watching that one next week.
Yeah.
And me thinking, oh, they're really pushing this. This is great. It's exactly how it should be. So, yeah. And obviously, we always go on about the Gatiss thing, but it is one of his great episodes, isn't it? And it's almost a bookend, is that and the Crimson Horror.
I think they work beautifully together. I've watched both of them quite close to each other recently, just to compare and contrast a bit. But there isn't that much difference, apart from the pacing is different in the Crimson Horror. It's a lot more...
snappy.
It's a lot more snappy. Wasn't it Saul Metzstein that did that one?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we know his style of filming. Very good. You know, that's very good. And I think if Saul had done this one, to me, it would have been utterly perfect. Mm. Utterly perfect. Mm. It was almost there. Almost there. Not quite. Almost.
Of course, Eve Mars in it as well. Great.
One of the problems with The Unquiet Dead that most of those early episodes suffered from is that they didn't know how long the episodes were going to be, and they all came in short and they all had scenes added, which disrupted the pacing. In this one, it's the scene in the cellar where she talks about, where she has a second sight and sees roses from the future. That scene was added in by Russell T. Davis. And of course, in Rose, it's the long speech, the long uninterrupted shot as they're talking about, just before he gets to the bit where he talks about the world turning. And in The End of the World, it's the bit where Rose meets the blue girl.
Mm. Mm.
That scene was added in as
well. Oh, really?
Yeah. That makes sense.
Which is why all those early episodes have got slight problems with pacing, because Doctor Who just moves so much faster than regular telly that you write as many pages for the minutes as you do for another programme, and it comes in 5 minutes quicker.
You know, Unquiet Dead could have been a lot more Hammer horror, couldn't it? It could have had, a hunched bloke driving the stagecoach or something like that, and he's the one that grabs Rose.
Oh, that would just be silly, Simon. They wouldn't do that in a Tom Baker episode, would they?
No, not at all. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It could have been more Talons, couldn't it? But,
or Morbius, even, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was just easing the audience into it, into the mode.
Yeah, definitely. And Simon Callow was a stroke of genius, simply because he was performing as Dickens for years and years and years. He'd go around doing readings of Dickens as Dickens. So if you're going to cast Charles Dickens, who are you going to put in the role? You get the guy who's been playing him.
But wasn't he just so good to allow himself to send himself up in such a way? Because he could have played that utterly, utterly straight. And he plays it knowingly straight,
because he had done Dickens on stage, hadn't he, before?
Yeah. That's why.
So as you say, he could have taken it seriously and said, "No, I take this completely seriously." And
no, he takes it very seriously, but with a nod and a wink every time the doctor. Yeah, and there's that beautiful scene early on where he's talking about Christmas and going home to the family and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
where he's throwing in all these just little odds and ends out of Dickens' actual life. And, obviously Callow's taking it, playing it straight, but with a knowing wink. And it's just a brilliant scene for the audience. Because even if you don't know about Charles Dickens' life, what you're recognising is the lives of the people who go on the Jeremy Kyle show and stuff like that. You know, it's instantly recognisable.
Yeah. Don't they mention at one point that he's nearing the end of his life?
Yeah, he's...
Which I think is another thing. It's this whole perspective on where they are in history and within people's lives.
That's a brilliant bookend for the story. You get the scene at the start where Rose takes her first footstep into history, and you get the scene at the end where Dickens realises they really are from the future, and the time machine goes off and the snow just flutters softly to the ground. And it's a brilliant bookend to the piece, because on the one hand you've got the character at the start who knows but hasn't felt it, feeling it, and at the other end of the story you've got the person who feels it but doesn't know knowing it. It's beautifully balanced.
It's under estimated that ending as being such a positive ending because you blow up a few people and some humans die in it, but generally speaking, it's the next most positive ending, I think, next to our favourite one with Stephen Moffat. What's it called?
Empty Jar,
thank you very much, with Everybody Lives, because he starts out, like you say, a depressive. He has got no more love for his fiction. He feels it feels like an old hack. It feels like the butter spread too thinly across the bread, you know, and he's going round trying to make money by just retelling the old stories, and he's got no love left, and he doesn't believe in the afterlife, something he's always wanted to believe, and he's finally coming to terms with the fact that spiritualism is a whole load of hunkum. And then you know, as the TARDIS disappears, you see him twisting around in the snow, laughing out loud, because his faith is restored in life and love, and it's such an optimistic ending. And it's also, like you say, it's beautifully kind of pinched. It's pinched slightly, that optimism, by, you know, Rosen, you know, does he know he's going to die, sort of thing. And well, you know, no, but he's going to die anyway. Whatever happens, he's going to die. And she gets a bit sad about it, but it really, I think it's a fantastically positive ending. It's lovely.
It's a lovely ending, that one.
Life-affirming, is that the word they use?
Life-affirming.
And of course, it's a happy ending for Charles Dickens, who just committed genocide on an entire species.
That's true.
Yeah. Murdering swine.
Well, it's Doctor Who. Hmm. Okay, we've been talking for very long. This episode, we said we were going to try and get done in 60 minutes, right?
Mm, yeah.
Okay. In that case, I'm not sure that it will be the rest of this podcast next week or the week after. So it could be the top 5 stories of Series 1 next week, or it may be something else, and we may have those the following week. But until then, I was JR.
I was Lee.
And I was Simon.
He's an idiot, isn't he?
Thanks, boys. And we'll speak again soon.
Sticks.
Hey, you're both in sync, but not with me.
There's a reason for that.
Well, we can't be in the same room together, otherwise we're short out time.
So fortunate that we're doing it on Skype then, eh?
Hey.